Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. We really appreciate it. Let people know about the show. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about the way you walk and what it can say about your health. Really interesting research and an app out of Ireland. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us science@newstalk.com or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me in studio is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Tammy Strickland, a PhD researcher from RCSI. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Tammy, is about mind reading.
I'm going to read your thoughts. Let's see now. You come here from a great distance?
Yeah, exactly.
Don't tell me. You want me to buy a subscription to the Saturday Evening Post?
No. I'm from the future. I came here in a time machine that you invented.
My God. Do you know what this means? It means that this damn thing doesn't work at all.
It is about reading minds, but it's in a very specific context, in the context of restorative neuroprosthesis. Now, when we think about the word prosthesis, we might think about, you know, replacing something that's been lost or that didn't develop in the first place, so something like an arm or a leg or some sort of other appendage, bodily appendage. However, when we think about a brain injury, it's a little bit trickier to imagine how do we kind of replace or kind of enhance a function that's lost in the context of something like stroke. So someone who's lost motor or communication functions. And now in the last 15 to 20 years, a lot of progress has been made in the field of what's called, as I mentioned before, restorative neuroprosthesis. So devices that are literally controlled by people's minds. So a recent study published in Nature Bioengineering by Edward Chang and colleagues from UCSF described how they implanted a series of electrodes into the brain of a young man who had suffered a stroke when he was aged only 20. The man was actually a Spanish speaker, and then he moved to the States to receive some treatment, quite an innovative treatment. And actually, he wanted to join to be studied as a young person with stroke to see the effects with aging, what would happen. 2 years ago, he was given a surgery to implant electrodes into his brain to be part of a study that allowed him to restore his speech, because part of his injury, his brain injury, involved losing his ability to speak.
Okay. And so the interesting thing about this study is this man in question could speak two languages.
Well, interestingly enough, he spoke Spanish when he had his stroke. And then in the time that he moved to the States to be part of the study, he learned English after the stroke. So yes, he is bilingual, but he learned English as an adult and after his injury. And it was kind of assumed that that would be quite tricky because it's quite difficult to learn languages as an adult. So actually, this study has taught us something else about learning language later in life and even after a brain injury.
So what does this mean then for helping him speak? Because is it helping him speak a language that he never spoke before?
It's helping him speak both languages. So essentially, it's not kind of giving him an advantage in terms of there's no stimulation involved in kind of helping his brain restore function. But what is happening is that he is able to, in the time that he spent, you know, in an English-speaking country, he's learned through assimilation English. And what he can do with this device is to initiate a speech, and the neural electrodes that are implanted in his brain can pick up which language he actually wants to communicate in and then can output that onto a computer screen. So the study involved him learning 200 words in English and Spanish. And based on the neural activity in his cortex where the electrodes were implanted, the algorithm that decoded his neural activity could decide whether or not he was trying to speak Spanish or trying to speak English.
Dude, sorry, you're telling me this is a brain implant that he can just think.
Yes.
And words come out, and the implant and the system behind it can actually identify what language he wants to speak in.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And so there's been a lot of different sort of brain-computer interfaces like this in the past number of years that have been involved in sort of improving motor function in people with, you know, who have suffered strokes. And there was another study in a person with ALS who also had a similar issue with speech, and it used a kind of a similar process. But what's really unique about this study is that it involved two languages, and the computer itself could determine which language was the preferred one in each case. Now, this man really wanted to relearn Spanish, or to be able to communicate in Spanish, because his family were all Spanish. So it was actually more important that he recover his native tongue as opposed to his learned.
That is so cool. Really great story. Our second piece, Ruth, has to do with this drug that we keep on talking about in this program, Ozempic.
Ozempic. Yes, another good news Ozempic story, and this time in relation to kidney disease. And this, you know, again, we associate Ozempic with weight loss, and we've heard about the benefits for cardiovascular health, but actually our heart health and our kidney health are very, very closely associated. And again, we've talked in the past that global rates of heart disease have actually dropped quite significantly over the past couple of decades with public health interventions like stopping smoking. But one cohort of people that haven't seen that reduction in heart disease deaths are people with chronic kidney disease. So this was a trial that was run by Novo Nordisk, who are the people who make Ozempic, along with the University of Washington. And they announced the results at a conference in Stockholm this week. So they had 3,533 people on a trial, and all of those had had diabetes type 2. And what they found was they actually had to stop the trial because they found it was unethical to continue to give people the placebo. The effects were so good. So those who were getting the semaglutide, the Ozempic injections weekly, were 24% less likely to have a major kidney disease event and dying owing to kidney disease complications. But they were also 29% less likely to have a heart disease issue or a heart attack and to die during the trial period. And they were 20% less likely to die from anything on the trial period when they looked at all other causes of death associated with type 2 diabetes. Mm. So this is, again, it's just really, really exciting to hear how this drug is really providing huge support potentially for patients where there just haven't been interventions that have worked in the past.
This is a question that comes out of complete ignorance, so you may or may not know the answer to it, but when it comes to this particular cohort, is obesity just intertwined with those type 2 diabetes patients? It's a major part of the condition that many battle with, right?
So yeah, absolutely.
Is it possible to medically cut out or separate kidney health from just the benefits of losing weight?
So they are two separate issues, because you will find people who have type 2 diabetes who are not overweight, who are able to manage their weight and who will still be at a much higher risk of kidney disease. In fact, type 2 diabetes is the biggest factor in determining that you will get kidney disease. About 30% of people who end up with kidney disease have type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
And what researchers think is that it may be related to anti-inflammatory effects in the kidney. So it's a kind of another whole area of interest in this whole story, which is sort of unfolding before our eyes over the last couple of years.
It's yet again another case of one of the situations where there is a dire public need. This is global health, and there is a solution here that we need to work with companies like Novo Nordisk to find a way get more people access to it. But I imagine they are working absolutely over that.
And it's about supply as well. Mm. It's just about getting enough of it made.
Our third story has to do with sleep, Tammy. And this is really interesting because for a long time, there's been lots of theories about why we sleep and why we dream and what's going on in our brain when we're not conscious. And this is looking a little bit deeper about this idea that the brain is being cleaned as we sleep.
Yes, it's quite a controversial paper that came out this week in relation to brain kind of deep cleaning during sleep and deep anesthesia as well. The previous kind of 12, 15 years worth of research has been really focused on this idea of sleep and the deep anesthesia being a time in which a system called the glymphatic system, which has only been kind of described in the last, say, 15 to 20 years, basically, it's very hard to see. That's why it took so long to kind of identify it scientifically. It's a system of glial cells in the brain that essentially sweep a fluid called cerebrospinal fluid across the brain and then drain it back into the circulation. And what was kind of noted by a scientist, a Danish scientist called Maiken Nedergaard in 2012, was that this happens primarily during periods of rest.
Right.
And many people have kind of substantiated this claim, but this recent paper has just kind of blown this theory out of the water a little bit, although there's a lot of debate, because what a group of researchers at Imperial College London have found is the opposite, is that actually fluid clearance is also, like cerebrospinal fluid clearance is also happening during active periods. So it's a hot topic, and it's kind of difficult to compare, mind you. It's like the scientific grey area, because the two groups have used very different methods. So it's a little bit difficult to compare, and I don't think either one ever really wants to lose the fight in many ways.
Right. And so what happens if we don't clean the brain in this way? And what do we mean by clean the brain?
Well, cleaning the brain is a very metabolically active organ. It consumes a lot of glucose and other kind of energy products during the daytime when we're doing lots of complicated things. We produce lots of proteins, and we have to kind of get rid of them and as kind of a gunk and get them back into the circulation to be kind of excreted elsewhere. So the brain needs to kind of restore itself, and that's really, and we know that because we feel terrible when we've stayed up all night having not slept. You can physically feel it. And I suppose what's really important about this is that if you don't have a functioning cleaning system within the brain, you can end up being predisposed to lots of different kinds of diseases. Hmm. For example, neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's diseases, disease and other neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's has been associated with a kind of impaired cleaning system.
Right.
Because the tangles and protein aggregates that build up in the brain aren't efficiently cleared. And this actually, this kind of glymphatic system has been known to kind of decrease its efficiency with age. So unfortunately, it's kind of a system that loses its ability over time.
Mm, yeah, which is not surprising, I suppose.
No.
So interesting, a bit of debate around this one as to, because they're not using the same metrics, so it's
exactly.
hard to tell.
Exactly.
Our final story, Ruth, has to do with another one of our hot topics in the programme, Epstein-Barr virus.
Yeah, and this is a virus that's a member of the herpes family, and about 90% of us are infected with it, which isn't great, I guess.
Speak for yourself.
And it's associated, I suppose, most commonly with glandular fever or mononucleosis. But for the most part, it lives latently inside us or inside wherever it is, and it only flares up in certain circumstances. So one of those circumstances would be something like after a transplant, but it could also happen with extreme stress. But I suppose that was kind of the view 10 years ago. This is just sitting there doing nothing unless you're unfortunate enough to come up against one of these triggers for it. But actually in recent years, it's been clear that there may be a link between this virus and many, many other autoimmune diseases like MS and rheumatoid arthritis. So people are kind of taking it a little bit more seriously now. And this is new research from the University of Basel, and it was published in Science this week. And what they've deciphered is how immune cells infected with this virus and sitting there kind of quietly, how they are kind of reprogrammed and transform and become active again. So what they've identified is that pathway. And what happens is the virus stimulates your infected immune cell, a B cell, to produce an enzyme called IDO1. And what this does is it ramps up the energy production inside the B cell. So it gets the mitochondria going and producing a lot of energy, and then the cells proliferate. And this allows the virus to proliferate and potentially kick off symptoms in the person. And of course, what's interesting here is that actually we already have inhibitors for this enzyme. So they've failed in the past as a potential cancer treatment. They obviously didn't work in certain cases, but they're there. And of course, now as we look at this virus differently, you know, one thing would be in advance of a transplant, you might give someone these IDO1 inhibitors to prevent Epstein-Barr virus getting a hold in that stressful situation for the body. But, you know, it may be useful in other cases where these viruses could flare up. And, you know, the good news as well is that Australian researchers, I think last year, announced they had an effective vaccine against Epstein-Barr virus. So, you know, it's one of those things we might go, you know, maybe we'd be better off without this. We kind of thought it was a benign passenger, but maybe it's not. And
I'm reading up that paper, it seemed that it's also linked to some forms of cancer. Like it could be a very serious target that maybe in 20 years our grandchildren will be getting the MMR.
EBV.
EBV, yeah.
Exactly, absolutely.
Very interesting. Dr. Ruth Freeman, thanks very much. Tammy, before you go, Soapbox Science is coming up. Tell me all about it.
So Soapbox Science is a street performance event where a group of 12 women and non-binary scientists get up on Soapbox and tell us all about what they do and what they're researching. It's going to be on South King Street this year, just at the top of Grafton Street. It's going to be a lot of fun. It allows everybody to have a good chat about what's going on in Irish research and specifically how women and non-binary people are involved.
If you pass by, do stop and listen. There's some fantastic communicators. I managed to meet some of them last week. How can people get details?
At Soapbox Science Ireland on Twitter and on Instagram.
At Soapbox Science. Tammy, thanks very much. Now, in our daily lives, we put a lot of stock in body language. We think that we can tell something fundamental about the character or the mood of someone simply by the way they enter a room. But the way we walk actually gives us so much more information, way more than you might think. Professor Sean Kennelly is a consultant geriatrician and director of the Institute of Memory and Cognition at Talley University Hospital. And he's joined by Dr. Aidan Boren, founder and CEO of Digital Gate Labs. You're both very welcome, gentlemen. This is a really fascinating story because it's about how we walk and our gait. And I learned on this show maybe 5 or 6 years ago that our gait is as unique to us as our fingerprint. And I learned this because of security. Why is that? How is our gait unique? Well, why is it so identifiable?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one of the key things is we're not born knowing how to walk. So we acquire the information and the knowledge around how our brain develops on how we walk. And then at later stages of life, we lose it in different fashions. So if you can imagine, we acquire it. And then as a result of different conditions that can affect us, we can lose it in a very different fashion. So right throughout our life course, our gait or how we walk remains very unique to us, dependent on our own circumstances.
So what can our gait tell us then?
So if, you know, well, one of the first things we teach actual medical students is never, ever pass up the opportunity to walk to the office door with the person you're just about to see. So actually, just from the point of view of diagnosis, it's an essential part of a clinician's diagnostic formulary is actually just seeing how somebody walks
really
to the door with you. Absolutely. So you can see if they're in discomfort, if they're in pain, you'll be able to see through their facial expressions and how they respond to different things. One of the key things is if they have to pause when you're talking to them. So if you're like, they're not able to dual task as easy, or even if they have to slow down. So actual very subtle things that we would notice. And actually intuitively, we pick up on these things all the time. We pick up when somebody might be in good form or when they're in bad form, when they're annoyed, when they're confident. Our subconscious is constantly identifying this kind of body language as we would traditionally. But most of that body language that we're looking at is a combination of facial expression and how we walk. When we're looking at, if you like, gait disorders, we often categorize them as, you know, higher, middle and lower gait disorders. Lower gait disorders are things like arthritis, where somebody has a sensory neuropathy whereby they're not able to sense the ground as well as they would have done, or if they have arthritis in their spine. Middle level gait disorders are where you might have a brain condition such as a stroke or Parkinson's disease or MS that causes you to have a specific motor symptom that changes your gait or changes how you can walk. And then higher level gait disorders, which are really interesting, are where as a result of protein depositions or multiple tiny strokes, you still have the same power, sensation, reflexes, but actually you're not able to put the sequence of walking together. So these higher level gait disorders are what we would commonly see in people who may be developing dementia. And we know about 6 or 7 years before people have memory symptoms, we see these significant changes in their gait pattern, whether they slow down or whether their cadence changes or their stride lengths. And actually, we can even get an indication as to what type of dementia they may have as a result of those gait changes.
Wow.
The difficulty we've always had is it's very, very hard to measure them reliably and accurately from one point in time to another point in time.
Yeah, I want to get into that in a second, but how have we traditionally been doing this?
So on the wards, I mean, so most of it is observation. Okay, so in clinical settings, it's nearly always observational. Sometimes at the most sophisticated level, it might be 2 lines stuck to the floor. You know, sometimes it might be 4 meters apart, 6 meters apart, 10 meters apart. So it's highly variable.
And what are you measuring there?
So you're generally measuring the length of time it takes somebody to walk between those 2 lines, be it 4 meters, and you're measuring their gait speed.
Now, hang on a second. My mom, she used to run a million. She literally run us up the pier in Dunleary. And we have other relatives that we would walk and they would always be left for dust. My mum just naturally walks much faster. But her relatives wouldn't necessarily have been less healthy, would they? I mean, is the speed at which you walk naturally really an indicator, or is it not more individual than that?
So it's actually your normal paced speed as opposed to how fast you're able to push yourself to walk.
Right.
So when we're trying to measure it, we're not looking to see what's the maximum speed that somebody can do. Now, there's different ways we test it. Sometimes it's just a normal pace. Sometimes we look for as fast as somebody can walk. And you're right, your mum can probably walk very fast, but you know, if she's unwell, I bet she doesn't walk as fast.
As she's gotten older.
That's the difference.
As she's gotten older, her pace has completely dropped off. And actually, I've noticed also that how she moves her feet is different.
Yeah, so we tend to, you know, when the, if you like, synchronicity between all those different areas isn't as smooth, we might shuffle a little bit more. We may not lift our feet as easy. And when you put that together then, where somebody might have a wee bit of arthritis in their hip, so you get that synchronicity of how the brain's connecting along with this other peripheral issue or reduced sensation, and that's where the differences come. This is kind of where we talk a lot about personalized medicine. So we have this table of what people's gait speeds should be in meters per second for all ages. But actually, it's not really what excites me as a clinician isn't necessarily that I can compare, you know, somebody to another, you know, 50-year-old male who, you know, we know is, what I want is the longitudinal track. That's where the real value
individual
is.
Individual longitudinal
track. So me to know what somebody's gait speed is when they're well versus now where I'm seeing it, they're not saying that they're particularly unwell, but they're saying they're not feeling great. And I can see that there is this really good, it's like taking somebody's temperature.
Mm.
It's a really good barometer that something's not right with the system. It's not terribly specific because there are lots of things that can affect how we walk, but it's very, very sensitive towards highlighting that somebody's not as well as they were beforehand.
God,
when we look at 30% of older people have a gait disorder. And this is where the important context for where we get to measure this, when we look at the, you know, the aging demography, when we look at the fact that, you know, people who are born today have a life expectancy probably of 105, 106 years as things stand. I mean, it's stunning when you think about the longevity that's happening. But we need to get better at identifying the risk periods as opposed to waiting for when somebody is going to have the issue or has had the issue. It's around predicting so that we can intervene with rehabilitation beforehand.
So Aidan is the technologist here. This seems like a really interesting area to explore. Presumably you didn't invent a stopwatch app. tell us about your app. What exactly does it do and how does it help clinicians figure out what's going on inside people?
Sure. So it's 2019, I think I met Sean for the first time, and he set some really challenging technical issues in terms of how you might go about measuring gait and gait assessments. And they kind of divide into actually applying a technology in a clinical setting, which is different than doing it in a lab. And what we need to be able to do is to measure gait. Sean mentioned longitudinal. So we need to be able to measure it anytime, anywhere, and anybody needs to be able to do it as well. So currently maybe physiotherapists and occupational therapists and consultants levels will be doing it, but why not push it further out and have public health nurses or GPs or even carers at home monitoring gait? So the challenges for us were on the technology side is anyone needs to be able to do it anywhere at any time. We need to be able to do it in a standard way. So whether I do it or Sean does the test or you do the test, you're going to get the same result.
Yeah, because there has to be a benchmark that you're going off. Otherwise,
so standardization in terms of how the test is run, the objectivity of the result is really important as well. So we need the validation against the gold standard. So there are high-end systems that you can use to measure various aspects of gait, and we've validated ourselves against those. So at the anyone, anywhere, anytime, the standardization, and the final really challenging thing was the patient perspective. So we're trying to not burden the patient anyway. So no sensors. We don't want them to have to wear anything, no shoes, special clothing. We don't want to have them haul them into a particular room or area in the hospital.
Because that would possibly change how they walk. They might be doing it more consciously and so on and affect the data, yeah.
Yeah. So how do we solve that? Well, we fused two technologies, augmented reality and artificial intelligence. So the augmented reality is what the clinician sees when they're using the app. And what it does basically is it coaches or guides whoever's using the app through the process of video recording what the gait assessment is. So it tells or instructs the clinician to tell the patient to stand in a particular area, and they can verify that using the viewfinder on their phone. It marks out a virtual start and end for the test. And it also tells the clinician where to stand as well, guides them through 3-2-1 walk. They start the camera, stop the camera, all of that handled automatically.
And presumably with this, you're gathering not just the speed, but also the motor use of the person in terms of how they're going about achieving those steps.
Yeah, so two technologies. So the augmented reality is really there to standardize the recording. All we're grabbing is the video, nothing else.
Right.
Video is sent then to our AI processor, artificial intelligence. So we've built an algorithm which breaks the video down that we've recorded, and it pulls out 25 points on the body. So kind of shoulders, the hips, knees, ankles, feet and hands. 25 points on the body, and it does that 60 times per second. So that's this insane amount of...
it's like a stop-motion camera in a way, but without all the stupid ping-pong balls.
It would be exactly like wearing 25 ping-pong balls, right, 25 sensors, and grabbing that data at 60 times per second. But with that chunk of data, we process that, and we provide back within 2 to 3 minutes for a typical gait test. We give the results, and the results are in initial stages, we're talking longitudinal gait speed, but we also do a lot of the other things that you were talking about. So foot position, so the heel strike, where the foot is in the planted position, where the toe is toeing off, what we call toe off. We do that for left and right feet. So although in theory, measuring gait speed is, hey, it's distance and time. What's the problem?
Yeah.
Well, when do you start? When do you stop? How do you measure the left versus the right? It needs to be divided by the gait cycle as well in terms of how the patient moves through that. AI and AR, we call that a digital gait lab, and that's what's new.
Yeah. Giving this information then to the clinician, Sean, what can you do with that? I mean, what can you tell from a much more accurate picture of the motor pathway of someone walking along the line, as well as the speed that they're traveling at?
Yeah, so I suppose my main clinical specialty is working with older people, so being able to first of all, use the speed to see where they're at relative to where they were before, and then actually
on the speed, that speed alone can't really tell you much about Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, can it? It can tell you there might be something wrong.
Oh, no. So we know actually when gait speed is declining, gait speed declines ahead of any memory symptoms that we see with Alzheimer's disease. And even when we look at pathology studies.
But could it not be something else that causes
it? Yeah, so it could, but it will provoke. So there's one of the other elements that we worked into this is where we are able to measure response time to instruction.
Right.
We're also able to measure and separate out acceleration time, and then we have actual gait speed. So we have a response time for when I, as the clinician, instruct somebody, and I'm able, the AI is able to accurately pick out that response time. So I'm able to look at that processing skills task that somebody has in responding to what I said. And then the acceleration. So if you take somebody with Parkinson's disease, ignition failure is often one of the key things that's an issue with them. We see that also with vascular dementia, where ignition failure is, they're very, very slow to get going. When they get going, actually often have a normal gait speed, but are very, very slow to get started because of the area of the brain, the basal ganglia, that's affected. In somebody with Alzheimer's disease, often we see an elongated stride length.
Right.
Whereas with somebody with vascular dementia, we often see a shortened step length. Actually, stride length is, and as a result, you will have a reduced number of steps per minute in somebody with, let's say, Alzheimer's disease, or who's developing what's likely to be Alzheimer's disease, because it just takes in so many different cortical areas. So be it, visual processing task for some types of Alzheimer's disease, or it's not actually just the motor centers. The limbic center is one of the main centers. When we look at the areas of the brain that's most predictive for gait, you'd intuitively say the motor center, which is in our frontal lobe, or the sensory center in our parietal lobe, that those are going to be the key ones. But actually the limbic center, which is where memory and emotional context is one of our key things. So actually, there's a whole sequence where our brain automatically puts in context the action I'm about to do in this setting.
Say tomorrow I come up with an Alzheimer's drug or a Parkinson's drug. Presumably, you would be able to see in using this app measuring the gait of how someone walks, you'd be able to see if that drug is working.
Yeah, so digital biomarkers as our gait and to a certain extent as our speech are really, really important. And we're actually nearly at tomorrow where we have medicines for Alzheimer's disease. And like FDA has just approved medicines and the European Medicines Agency are looking at an approval for a medicine to remove these proteins. But yeah, if we look at how even if we take today, we give dopamine to treat Parkinson's disease. And one of the key things we want to see is when we replace that dopamine, that chemical that's depleted in the brain of people with Parkinson's disease, that they're having a response to it. Hmm. Or whether or not we need to increase the dose. And sometimes people with Parkinson's disease have these freezing episodes. And as it is as a clinician now, they're having to come in and try and describe to me, and I get them up to walk, but actually it's hard to know, I saw it 6 months ago, do I have accurate information? Am I remembering it accurately?
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to piece it all together, and often these conditions understandably have an emotional context for the person who's living with the symptoms, so you're trying to separate out or integrate at least that emotional context versus reality before you adjust these medicines. But I think gait probably has even a bigger role in that we'll have blood tests, hopefully, to be able to screen for things like Alzheimer's disease in the not too distant future. What gait is able to do is maybe to a much broader mass at a much lower level of intervention. So it's part of your 6 month screening program that you would be doing with your GP, where they're checking blood pressure, you know, cholesterol. Gait is one of those things that could really give a good indicator of somebody's wellness. And if it's fine, it's fine. But if it's changed, a deeper dive.
I was at the BioInnovate Symposium a few weeks ago, and it's amazing when you dig deep how many unmet needs, the effect of them, and the problem that is if it's solved, the reward is pretty huge, and that's I presume a big carrot for you when it comes to actually getting this out as an approved medical device, Aidan. Where are you with that? Is it out available commercially in the markets in Europe and America?
It is. So in Europe, so we're CE marked and we're a class one medical device, so regulated by the European Medicines Agency. And what that does is that gives us license to measure things. We don't diagnose and we don't treat, obviously, as a technology. We simply measure. We're a thermometer. And we like to think of ourselves as a thermometer for
walking, yeah.
But that's enough. You know, that's the important breakthrough, is that we can do that anywhere, that was difficult to do, particularly in the healthcare settings where it's needed.
Well, it sounds very promising, I suppose, integrating it into clinical practice internationally in the GP's surgery or wherever it is people are getting their care is the next step. But very, very interesting. Speaking to you both, that's Dr. Aidan Boren, founder of Digital Gait Labs, and Professor Sean Kennelly from Tally University Hospital. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I remember hearing that security companies were using gait recognition to identify perps. That actually, you know, face recognition, people can cover your face and so on. But like, you know, if you got a juve, as they were called in Judge Dredd, perps
have
and juves.
Have you been watching Law and Order?
I've been reading a lot of 2000 AD. You can now recognize, because you can hide your face and, you know, you can put on gloves, but you can't hide the way you walk. Typically. Yep. And now these machines can actually literally, they can pinpoint you much easier just on very blurry video.
Could you not just do like the Monty Python, remember the school of insane walks or whatever it was?
You could. But
just
I think
walk
most,
insanely everywhere.
you could, but I mean, if you imagine, particularly in the UK and America, where the number of CCTV cameras are out there, like at some point, you know, you'll have to stop, you know, twisting your knee 360 degrees.
Yeah. It's funny though as well, because do you remember we did the Futureproof Gold on prosopagnosia, and my friend Colin Marrow was the guy we interviewed.
Yes.
And he had said before that even though he could never recognise his friends' faces, it was the walk that gave them away.
He'd
always see them coming down the road and be like, that's Aidan.
I know why.
Yeah. So we could play that in this Thursday's Futureproof feed.
Yeah, let's do that. So if you are looking for a little bit of a treat next Thursday, we're going to be doing a Future Proof Gold episode where we're going to play that piece that we did on prosopagnosia, because it's awesome. Well, that was producer Aidan McKelvey. Thanks to him and to Hugo da Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more, as we say, on Tuesday with the Future Proof Extra and Thursday with Gold. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.